Thanks, Walt. Thank you. So it's a little bit nostalgic for me to be here because I get to see guys like Walt, and I saw Bobby earlier, and Bill Leonard, and Jim Moy, some of these founders of FCCI. And as Walt said, our company kind of has grown up with FCCI. You know, Bruce Wilkinson, I was just reading the book on Jimmy Purcell, and it talks about the very first meeting that FCCI ever had. So it was really intriguing to me to read that and see all those names that have, essence, paralleled my career for all these years since I put everything in a U-Haul and moved from Kansas. But I appreciated what Chad sitting right there, I appreciate what you said this morning about what this next generation is asking for. They're asking for, you know, somebody to come alongside and deal with business and deal with family and deal with marriage, and how do you put all those things together? So what I'm going to do tonight in the short time we have together is maybe give you some perspective that I think can kind of help you. And when I think of perspective, I think of the young lady who went off to college. She wrote to Mom and Dad and said, "Mom and Dad, I'm sorry I haven't written to you sooner, but I was involved in the revolution here on campus. And when I was, you know, burnt down the administrative building, I was burned. But I'm here in this student hospital, and I'm recovering quite nicely. And I met a really nice orderly. He's a Hare Krishna, but don't worry, he's a really nice guy. And you can get your desire to become grandparents real soon. And you can come visit the baby in Nepal. Love, Susan." P.S. I'm not pregnant. I don't even have a boyfriend, but I did flunk chemistry and English, and I wanted you to keep that in proper perspective. So we need some perspective. You guys have sat here all week. I'm glad you're still here. Usually at these kind of conferences, by the time you get to the last night, so I'm just glad to see the seats are still full. So Chad, and it must be because of Walt, you're all still here, but thanks for still being here. But you've heard a lot of things. You know, you've heard about giving, you've heard about succession, you've heard about, you know, how do you deal with family, you know, how do you pass on your business. There's a lot of things. What I'm hopefully going to do is help you kind of put all that into a context. And the way I'm going to start that, you have a handout on your tables, so make sure you grab that. And I'm going to really talk about this life overview. But before I get into kind of the meat of this, let me give you some numbers. And you can write these down: 11, 15, 3, 20, 17. 11, 15, 3, 20, 17. Now, those are not the code to the safe at the Ron Blue Trust. That's not what those are. And it's not lottery numbers, okay? That's not what those are. You're saying, what is 11, 15, 3, 20, 17? Well, it was 11:15 on March 20th of this year that I picked up my phone in the car. It rang, and I answered it, and the lady said, "Hey, I'm just calling about your full body scan, and you have melanoma on your back." And you know, I was driving to see a client over in our Atlanta branch. It was about 11:15 in the morning, like I just said, and you know, I wasn't expecting to hear that. I know about basal cell, and I know about squamous, the next one, and I know those two are usually okay, but I had two close friends that were dead 3 months after the melanoma diagnosis. So needless to say, I went to the client meeting and I was able to get through that. But as I was driving back to the office, it was really a surreal thing because all of a sudden everything slowed down, everything just seemed different. I got back to the office and I was supposed to go to a meeting, and it was like they were all talking, but I really wasn't there because I'm thinking I'm not going to be there by this summer anyway. But here's the other thing that happened, and how I'm going to tie this to what I want to share with you. As I was driving from our Atlanta branch up to our headquarters in North Atlanta, I also had a distinct feeling that I had no regrets. That I didn't think, you know, I wish I need to go do something, or I need to hurry and do this or hurry and do that. I really had a peace. I had no regrets. And that's what I want for you. I want you to have no regrets. That was a tremendous mortality check. I went and got Mohs surgery a week later, and we had my first three-month checkup. I have an 8 times greater chance to have it again, but I figure 8 times a small number is still a small number, so I'm glad about that. And I go in next week for my second three-month deal, so at least I have some time here. But you know what? That was a great mortality check, and we all should have a mortality check. My wife and I were talking about that, because what it does is bring everything crystal clear as to how you've been living your life. And what I want to share with you is, how do you live a life well spent? How do you tie together the business, your family, your marriage, the money, the giving, all this stuff? How do you tie it together? In a nutshell, a life well spent is a life that earns and uses money to buy time to impact people. First and foremost, your kids, and then secondarily, the other people around you. And it's a focus on the eternal in the realm of the temporal. See, the reason I came up with this diagram years ago and the reason I could get that diagnosis and not have any regrets was because early on in my career, I sat with so many people that had made it their life's goal to build the financial capital and hadn't built spiritual and social capital. I sat there and watched tears streaming down their face, and I said, you know, somebody's got to stop the merry-go-round, have a time out, and say, wait a minute, let's get life in perspective. So as you look at that diagram, my first question for you is, how many of you have a problem with balance? Anybody have a problem with balance in life? That's kind of the left side of the diagram. Anybody? I got a couple honest people down here. We all have a problem with balance. We're only in balance as we're swinging through, right? Well, here's why there's a great challenge with balance. What are the two things that are the hardest to balance on the left side of that diagram in the circle? Which two are usually the hardest to balance? Work and family, right? Do you ever stop to think about that? Why is that? Why are work and family at such great tension? Well, the reason is, and many of you know it, because you started your businesses the same time you were starting your family, and you're growing your kids, and you're growing the business, and when you finally get the big house, and you get the business, and you get the money, you don't need it, and when you needed it, you didn't have it. It's backwards, right? It seems backwards. But that's the reality. You're starting your career, you're starting your business, you got little kids, and so somehow we have to figure out, how do we balance life so we can focus on what really matters so we don't have any regrets? Now, many of you in here know what I'm talking about because maybe you were one of those that did get kind of out of balance building your bills. It's not too late to help your kids and grandkids understand that there's a different way to live life. And that way to live life is to try to the best of your ability to live it with some kind of balance and focus on spiritual and social capital at the same time you're focusing on building financial capital. You see the definitions on the back of your sheet of those different capital. Everybody knows what financial capital is, stocks, bonds, real estate, things that you buy, you know, financial instruments. But let me propose to you that spiritual capital is understanding God's word and being able to apply it in your life. That's spiritual capital. How do you help the generations that come after you understand what the Bible says and know how to apply it? And social capital are simply the characteristics we want to build into our kids and our grandkids and our posterity that can help them be effective and productive in society. Things like integrity and honesty and punctuality and responsibility, all these kinds of things. And I would just say to you that you build social capital mostly by helping your kids learn to have a work ethic. See, this is where it gets real interesting. Sometimes the more affluent you are, the harder it is to help your children learn how to work. I had a client in the early years of the business. He had a very successful real estate gentleman up in Michigan. He had moved to Scottsdale, Arizona. And I remember him telling me, he said, Russ, I don't have to work, but I'm going back to work so my kids see me working. See, the interesting thing is, people think if they just had more money or had a more successful business, it'd get easier. No, it gets harder. Because now, how do you not undermine that work ethic? See, this is why it's much more than estate planning and all that. It's how do I deal with what God's entrusted to me, this business, in such a way to further His work around the world and also help my children learn to continue to do the same. Socrates says, what mean you fellow citizens, you turn every stone to scrape wealth together and take so little care of your children to whom one day you will relinquish it all. I liked what Richard Swenson said in his book, Margin. He said, we need room to breathe, we need freedom to think. Our relationships are being starved to death by velocity and our children lay wounded on the ground, run over by high speed good intentions. So men and women, you know, how do you live a life that's well spent? How do you begin to piece it all together with a fast-paced society, with business challenges, with family challenges down through the generations? I think the first thing starts with kind of understanding the perspective. That to the best of your ability, you're going to try to figure out how to balance life and not just have a focus on your financial capital net worth, but on your spiritual and social capital. So the reason you have that diagram is to kind of get a perspective. Now, we don't do it perfect, but I would propose to you that the reason you manage your money is not to have more money. You manage the middle part of that diagram to have more life and to be about what God has called you to do. And so that's what we've had the privilege of helping people do for over 37 years is deal with your money, not just to have more money, but to draw finish lines and figure out, you know, how do I deal with my children? How do I deal with my grandchildren? And how do I deal with what God's doing around the world? And so you see on the back, you know, the definitions of spiritual, social, and financial capital. I know some of you are going to look down there and say, okay, Russ, there's blanks here. You have to fill them out. So Psalm 37 talks about the word posterity. I was going to entitle the book Prosperity versus Posterity, but everything's posterity is your rear end. Okay, so that's why we did not title the book that, okay? But Psalm 37 talks about posterity, and posterity is just simply a word for those that come behind you, first and foremost your children and other people that you impact. Psalm 49 talks about prosperity. In fact, just tonight when you go back to your room, you might want to read that Psalm 49 passage because it says man builds buildings, he buys land, he puts his name on it, and he thinks it's going to endure, but it's not going to endure. See, the only legacy we can leave, and it was up here on the slides earlier, the living messages you send to a time you will not see are your children. They're the living message. So, you know, you can put your name on it. You can name your business after yourself. You can have land named after you, and that's all fine, but that's not what's going to last, okay? That's not what is going to last. And at the end of the day, it's all just financial capital. One of the biggest challenges we have is that we get so personally engrossed and tied into our businesses that that becomes our identity and other things, and we forget that it's just financial capital. And I know there's blood, sweat, and tears in it and all that, but it's still financial capital. It's not unlike Coke stock or a bond or your house or whatever. It's still financial capital. So the big idea is we have to learn to get some balance. I probably better keep this up here, right, so that I don't leave out any blanks. Kevin, tell me if I leave out any blanks. So that's the big idea. I want to try to balance life and build in three types of capital, not just one. See, when I first started in the business, I would have said you just invest in financial capital, okay? Now on my budget, I have a line called posterity line. In my budget, I've built in a number that I invest in getting the kids, you know, to Atlanta or going on a family vacation or you fill in the blank, but it changed my thinking. It used to be you just had your living expense budget. I've got a living expense budget, but I've also added a posterity line because rather than just letting it drop down to the bottom and have margin to put in stocks and bonds and back in the business, I'm investing intentionally in posterity. And it just helps me to have that line out there, you know, so I'm investing differently, and I would encourage you to think about that. So let's talk about how we need to think. This is all a thinking problem. Remember, Eric said this morning that there's nothing so difficult as to think well. So let's talk about three areas we think incorrectly about money that cause us to get out of balance or contend to cause us to get out of balance. And the first one, as you see there, is that we think money is a measure of self-worth. Money is not a measure of self-worth. But unfortunately, we stack everybody up. You know, what do you do? You know, where do you live? We stack everybody up based on kind of their financial picture, okay? As you see in those verses, Deuteronomy 8 says, you think it's your ability to make wealth? No, I, the Lord, have given you the ability to make wealth. Proverbs 22:2, the Lord, the rich and the poor have a common bond. The Lord is the maker of both of them. Okay? So what you and I have is because of God's grace to us, what He's allowed us to build in our businesses or whatever, but it simply come from His hand. And we should not measure our worth by our financial net worth. We should realize that simply come from God and have a little different perspective. But many times we're out of balance because we're trying to build a bigger financial net worth because that's where we've got our self-worth tied up. Now, the way this came home to me and kind of understanding this is what I call the principle of limited sphere. That's the next blank there. Let me tell you what that's all about. So Julie and I... when the kids were young, we'd go to Kansas on vacation. Anybody gone to Kansas on vacation? Yeah, okay, good. Yeah, it's a beautiful state. But, you know, we'd get in the car and we'd head back to Kansas. And sometimes we would, you know, go on to Colorado to the mountains. You know, Kansas gets a bad rap. Eastern Colorado is way uglier than Western Kansas. It's just that you're almost to the mountains, so Colorado gets a break. Okay, I'm sorry for all you people here from Colorado, but, you know, they get a break. But anyway, we'd get in the car and we'd head off to to Kansas, about to see the grandparents and stuff. And so what we had a tradition, Julie and I, we said, okay, we're going to get off the interstates and we're going to go on the two-lane roads and see the countryside. And so get your picture in your mind. You're off on the two-lane roads and you're coming up to these small towns, right? And here's this great big house up on the hill, big white fence around it, 40, 80 acres, Hereford cattle out there. This is the person that has the financial capital. This is the businessman, the doctor, the lawyer, the person that runs the manufacturing company. They're the person that's built the financial capital. Big house on the hill, you see it. You go on through town, the houses get a little bit smaller. You go across the railroad tracks, a bunch of double-wide trailers, and you're out of town. You got the visual? So 30 miles down the road, what happens? 30 miles down the road, the same thing happens. Another little town, right? Big house. The wealthy side of town, smaller houses, double-wide trailers, and you're out of town. And then it dawned on me. The person in this town doesn't even know the person in this town, and so it went all across the country. And I realized that if you make it your goal to amass financial capital at the expense of spiritual and social capital, how many people will ever know what you have? Think about that. I don't know where you guys live. I don't know what you drive. It's maybe 150 people, maybe you have a lot of people that know where you live, but you get in the picture? If you make it your goal to build financial capital and that's what your worth is tied to, you will only impact a limited sphere of people because only a limited sphere of people are ever going to know what you have. But if you invest your money in what God's doing around the world and you get involved in missions and you get involved in investing in your family, you can impact an unlimited sphere of people. The goal is that old Ray Bolts song about thank you. Remember that? Thank you for giving. My goal for you would be the goal that I have. You know, you want to get to heaven and have a long line of people standing up to thank you because you made it your goal to impact an unlimited sphere of people, not just a limited sphere of people. And you have the opportunity to do that with your business. You have to do that when your communities, as you think about your business differently and you think about, I'm not just building a bigger barn here. Fact is, I'll give you 2 four-letter words about your giving, and this isn't in the notes, but this is free of charge. You know, 1 Timothy, as Eric unpacked, the key word there is wise. You want to be wise, and a wise person is generous and purposeful. Or you can be like the farmer over in Luke 12, and what was he called? He was called a fool, because he said, I'm just going to build up bigger barns, and that's what I'm going to do. So men and women, we want to be wise, not foolish. None of you want to be a fool. And so you do that by changing your thinking on how do you steward what this business and what God's entrusted to you. And the first thing you do is you start realizing that I want to invest the impact in an unlimited sphere of people. And for heaven's sakes, don't be out of balance trying to build a big financial statement to impress people because there's only a few people that are ever going to know anyway and nobody really cares. And somebody's always got more than you anyway. And the next verse on there is 1 Corinthians 4:7. That what do you have that you weren't given? So the first reason we get out of balance is we start thinking that our net worth is somehow tied to my personal worth. The second way we get out of balance is we get discontent. How many of you make more money today than you did 15, 20 years ago? Anybody here doing better than you were 10 or 15 years ago? Yeah. So 10 or 15 years ago, if you thought that you were making what you're making today, you probably thought you'd be content. Well, now the question is, are you content? See, the question is, you have to learn to be content. Paul says, I've learned to be content, whether I have much or whether I have little. So I learned this principle, and see, you can't make enough to be financially content. Early in my career, when I started, I made the mistake of telling Ron what I made teaching. I was a math teacher and a coach, and I told Ron I made $15,000. He said, well, that's what I'll pay you. And I'm like, Ron, that's 9 months. I paint houses in the summer to supplement. But anyway, so I took a pay cut. Kind of the joke was pay cut to come to work for this financial services company. So, but I come down to Atlanta, and I'm making $15,000. And I meant to see a client out in California, and he was making 40 times that. So I know it's late at night. You've been here all week, but you can probably figure out that's $600,000, right? But it was interesting. I met with this gentleman, and he was spending $700. I know what you're thinking. Well, you're thinking, hey, let me try $600 for a while and I won't spend $700, right? That's what you're thinking. That's what everybody thinks. Just let me try that. I won't do it. But there's a very interesting principle. If you don't learn to spend less than you make where you are, you always spend a little bit more no matter how much you make. So you have to learn. At the top part of that diagram, you have to learn to have a positive margin no matter where you are. So young people, You know, I speak at colleges sometimes, and I ask the people, you want to be a millionaire? And they go, yeah. And I go, well, you want how to do that? Yeah. Well, you spend less than you make and do it for a long time. It's not real complicated. It's hard to do because we live in a consumptive society. But the point is, I learned about contentment that had nothing to do with how much you make. I came back, went into the apartment, and walked up to Julie, and I said, honey, I learned a very important lesson on this trip. It's not how much you make, but it's spending less than you make. And I was spending $14,999. But I had more contentment than this gentleman making $600. So we have to learn to be content. And I love this story about contentment. An American businessman was at the pier of a small coastal Mexican village when a small boat with just one fisherman docked. Inside the small boat were several large yellowfin tuna. The American complimented the Mexican on the quality of his fish and asked him how long it took him to catch him. The Mexican replied, only a little while. The American then asked, well, why don't you stay out there longer and catch more fish? The Mexican said, he had enough to support the immediate needs of his family. The American then asked, but what do you do with the rest of your time? The Mexican fisherman said, I sleep late. I play with my children. I take a siesta with my wife, Maria. I stroll into the village each evening where I sip wine and play guitar with my amigos. I have a very full, busy life, senor. American scoffed. I'm a Harvard MBA, and I can help you. You should spend more time fishing. With the proceeds, buy a bigger boat. And with the proceeds from the bigger boat, you could buy several boats. Eventually, you would have a fleet of fishing boats. Instead of selling your catch to the middleman, you could sell directly to the processor. Eventually, opening your own cannery, you would control the product, processing, and distribution. You need to leave this small coastal fishing village, move to Mexico City and L.A., and eventually New York City, where you could run your expanding enterprise. The Mexican fisherman asked, Senor, how long will all this take? The American replied, 15 to 20 years. But then what, Senor? The American laughed and said, that's the best part of all. When the time is right, you would announce an IPO, sell your company stock to the public, and become very rich. You would make millions. Millions, senor, then what? American said, then you would retire, move to a small coastal fishing village where you would sleep late, fish a little, play with your kids, take a siesta with your wife, stroll into the village and sip wine and play guitar with your amigos. You know, I love that story because we don't want to do that because here's the problem with that. Even though you end up in the same place, guess what happens 20 years down the road? Your kids are already gone. See, the issue with that story is it's not the same. And that's what I would challenge you with is how do you begin to balance life as you're building a growing business? I mean, one of the practical ways some of our clients do this is they will just hire, they may take some of the profit to hire some more help so that they don't have to spend so much time at the office. That's an intentional decision so they can spend that time, you know, with their children or grandchildren or whatever it might be. So the second thing we have to do is learn to be content and kind of enjoy the trip. I think that's one of the things I've learned in my career over all these years is you want to enjoy the trip. You know, you don't want to just, you know, it's like that Cats in the Cradle song. Remember that? You know, hey, Dad, come play catch. I don't have time, don't have time, don't have time. And then he grows up and he doesn't have time. He's got a plane to catch and all that. We don't want that. We don't want that. So we have to learn to be content. The third thing we have to think right about is that money is not a measure of success. Now, you got the definitions on the back of your sheet there, so you don't have to fill in all those little blanks, but you know, you have definitions of success and prosperity and wealth and riches. And wealth and riches are comparative in nature. It's okay to say somebody is richer than somebody else or somebody is wealthier than somebody else. But success and prosperity have to do with accomplishing a desired end or aim. They have to do with accomplishing what God has put before you to do. You can be successful and have money. You can be successful and not have money. But our language betrays us here. Because we attribute success to, you know, hey, they have a successful business. Hey, you know, they have a successful job. But because we look at what they drive and what they wear and we use success. When was the last time you used success in the same sentence as the butcher at your local market? Or the UPS person that drops stuff at your house? See, we don't think of success in those terms, but who's to say they're not more successful potentially than the person you think successful just because they have the trappings of success? Joshua 1:8 is the verse here. It says, this book of the law shall not depart from your mouth, but you shall meditate on it day and night and be careful to do according to all that is written in it. For then your way will be prosperous and everything you do will have success. I used to read that verse and think, well, it says right there in the Bible that if I do what's written in here, I'm going to have money. That's what I thought that verse meant. But read it. It says, if you're careful to do according to all that is written in here, then you'll be prosperous and have success. So men, when you love your wife as Christ loved the church, that's true success. When you raise up your children and you teach them as you walk by the way, as you rise up and as you lie down, that's success. When was the last time you saw a young couple come to your church and you went up and said, man, I really appreciate how you're raising your family. You're a success in my eyes. I'm really appreciating watching how you're doing that. We don't do that, do we? I want to challenge you, the next time the word success comes across your lips, I hope you'll have a pause to think, how did I just use that? Okay? Because I would predict that in most cases you won't be using it correctly, because it won't be about what God says is important. It'll be more what the world has told us success really is. What about Colossians 3:23? When you do your work heartily, you're a success. See, it's not just the profit margin or whatever that says you're a success. It's how you go about doing it. That's what's written in the scripture. That's why I've heard, and Chad, you said, this new generation must know, how do I apply biblical principles? Well, I treat my employers and my employees in a really good way. We just did an interesting thing recently. We just went from being Ron Blue and a company, an RIA, to a trust platform, and we had a lot of legal fees and a lot of things we did on all that, and one of the companies we used had chosen, you know, they'd given us a flat retainer. So we obviously, you know, it took more than that. And so my CFO came to me and said, hey, Russ, I want to send a pretty substantial check to these guys just because, you know, what they did. And so he sends a check. Now, this is kind of unheard of, right, to a law firm. And, you know, we didn't have to do that. They were so blown away. I mean, the guy was speechless when he called and wanted to make sure, first of all, that that was really, you know, that was really that amount, and that was really what it should be. But that's how we should run our companies, is how we treat our employees and our vendors and all of that. That's true success. Profit margin's obviously a part of it. You got to be a healthy company, and that's all part of it. So big idea here is the reason we get out of balance is we incorrectly think that it's a measure of our worth, so we tend to overwork. We're discontent. We think, if I just had a little bit more, I'd be content. You're never going to be content if you don't learn to be content where you are. And thirdly, we incorrectly think that success is tied to our financial picture. And none of those things are true. Now, let me just talk for a minute. On your diagram there, you have a thing about children. So I want to just talk about that for a minute, the truth about your kids. So, you know, one of the things I've noticed in my career is that many times we're overworking or we're getting out of balance. We want our kids to not have it like we had it. I told my boys early on, boys, I want you to have it like I had it. You know, I grew up on a farm in Kansas. It was pretty easy to learn a work ethic. It was pretty easy to go without. It was pretty easy not to have anything. But, you know, that's one of the problems with wealth. The more you have, it's harder to. So I made sure the boys knew that, no, this, you know, they were going to learn to work. So you want your children you want to have them learn some of the same things you had to learn. This is where estate planning gets so interesting. You know, you work really hard and you have this big estate, but then, you know, the very way you got there and the character you had to get there, you want to make sure is in your children. So how do you do that? And that's just part of what you have to talk through. So what you want to do, the key punchline here, is you want to teach your children to be productive and content, not consumptive. Productive and content, not consumptive. You do your children a tremendous disservice if you teach them to be consumptive. I married a doctor's daughter after she told me no when I first asked her to marry me because she didn't want to be poor. I was a school teacher making $7.50 a month. I don't know what was wrong with that, but anyway, that's a whole other story. I have to have Julie tell that story. But seriously, she grew up in a doctor's family. She thought everybody had Cadillacs and private airplanes, okay? They flew a V-tail bonanza around and all that. So I come along and seriously, I asked her to marry me on a Sunday night. She told me no, but God got a hold of her 4 days later and she called back and said yes. But here's what her parents did. They did a good job of telling her, this is our stuff, not your stuff. Don't get used to it. Because the guy that you marry may not be able to provide for you at the level that we have. Here's the punchline, men and women. Future marriages hang in the balance on this whole issue of how much money you leave when and to who. And, you know, most estate planners aren't even going to talk to you about the marriage angle of this. But if you teach your daughter to be content, like Julie's parents did her, then she could choose to fit into a teacher's salary. And we're coming up on 39 years here. It was past 38, and it's been wonderful. But, you know, see, that's why this is so interesting. It's not just about money. There's all these relational dynamics, right? And so teach them to be productive and content. What about your sons? If you give your sons too much, they'll say, well, they should have made it. Their dad gave it to them. If they don't make it, they'll say, well, they should have made it. Their dad gave it to them. So you got to figure this out. And there's no easy answers. I talk about it a little bit in the book, Your Life Well Spent. But the point is, we want to teach them to be productive and content, not consumptive. Because then that sets them up to be in a lot better position long term. I think the issue is, you sure shouldn't be out of balance to try to give your kids stuff. What's the worst thing that happens to your kids if you don't give them a lot of stuff? What's the worst thing that happens to them? They have to learn to work and do stuff just like you did, and build character, and go through the struggles, and go through the tough times. And, you know, that wasn't hard. You know, I remember, this will date me a little bit, when I was in high school, my parents couldn't afford the new Adidas basketball shoes that came out. You know, the white ones with the three black stripes? Some of you remember those. Because all we could afford were the canvas Converse from Sears or the Penny's Jeepers. And they were like $8, you know. So, but I learned as a junior in high school that didn't really affect how I played. And so my parents couldn't buy me the nice shoes. Well, the problem with wealth is sometimes now you can do all that, but the question is, should you? And how do you do it? And so I'm not up here tonight to give you answers. I'm just here to say that these are the kind of things that you have to wrestle with as you're trying to live this balanced life. You're trying to help your children not be consumptive. And then you're having to try to figure out, you know, how do you leave stuff so you don't undermine future generations. Psalm 78, 5 to 7 says, He commanded our fathers that they should teach them to their children, that the generations to come might know, and they would teach them to their children. So four generations in those two verses. And what they're supposed to teach them is to put their confidence in God and not forget the works of God, but keep His commands. So that's Psalm 78, 5 to 7. You might want to look that up. It's a tremendous passage. There's four generations there. But we're to teach our kids to put their confidence in God, not forget the works of God, but keep His commandments. See, isn't it interesting? When you started your business, you had a lot of faith, right? You didn't have anything, so you go by faith. And what happens is, as we have success, we begin to not have faith in God and show our kids confidence in God. We begin to put our faith in the blessing and the power that God's allowed us to accumulate. You know how I know this? I went through 08, 09. And I watched how people handled 08, 09. It showed where their focus was. And my encouragement to you is the same faith that you had to start your business, you need to keep that same faith to model to your kids. And one of the ways you do that is through increasing your generosity, because that helps get your hand off of it. Like I told somebody, I would challenge you, and they didn't pay me to say this, and so Chad, I'm sorry, but I'm going to say it. Many of you came here this weekend and you were thinking, I'm going to give, you know, X amount to help FCCI. It's been tremendously meaningful to me. I would encourage you to double it or add a zero to it. Yeah, I did say that. I just said that. And the reason is all kinds of fold. You probably can do it, and it's probably going to help you have more faith when you do that. It's going to get you out of your comfort zone. Anyway, that's not in the notes, and that wasn't even part of what I was going to say, so sorry, I hope I didn't get step on anybody's toes there, but that's back to being wise versus being foolish. So have faith and model that for your kids, as it says in Psalm 78. So just a comment on retirement, because that's the other thing that's kind of exacerbated this inability to balance life. All of a sudden now everybody's in a hurry to quit, you know? And this is a new phenomenon. The Social Security Act of 1935 came into existence, and it came into existence to get the older guys out of the workforce. They set retirement at age 65 when life expectancy was 62, and they wanted to get the young people back into the workforce. Then the private pensions came into existence, and then you got the unions involved, and so the idea of pension and retirement became mainstream in the 50s and 60s, and then the marketers got a hold of it. And the marketers got a hold of the idea of retirement, and they started painting pictures of a retired couple up in the mountains or a retired couple on the beach. Okay? So now what's happened is you're trying to start your family, you're trying to start your business, and you're trying to hurry and quit. And that's exacerbated the inability to focus on spiritual and social capital and have some semblance of balance in your life. And I would just encourage you, I'm not against retirement. I'm not against accumulating money in retirement. But I'll tell you my personal story. I saw this early on, and as I worked with clients, and I told Julie, I said, okay, we're going to pay the house off first. That'll give us some options. So when the kids are younger, I can coach their football team or their basketball team or their soccer team or whatever. And so there were years, now I'm going to say this, I am a financial guy and I understand compounding. There were years I didn't put any money in retirement. I didn't. I'll confess, I didn't. I don't have any regrets though, because you know what? First of all, retirement's not even biblical. The only place you see the word retirement used in the Bible is when they retire from battle. And we would like to say it's rehirement, and many of you are doing that. Many of you are volunteering and doing other types of things. But the problem with the retirement that America talks about is it puts this in, and it causes people to try to do everything in a shorter period of time, when if they just extended their time horizon, they would hopefully be able to live a more balanced life and focus on posterity along the way. So that's really all I want to say about retirement is don't be in a hurry to quit. And keep it in proper perspective about where it fits in the context of your life. So you guys have heard a lot this week, but hopefully this little diagram will help you realize that, okay, I do have to deal with my children and grandchildren, how I leave assets, you know, financial capital, spiritual and social capital. How can I invest in spiritual and social capital? There's ways to do that. You know, when I take the kids to a Young Life camp in Colorado, that was a spiritual capital investment. It wasn't just a vacation. That was a different way of thinking for me. Or when I take them on a mission trip to Brazil, that was an investment. In fact, as I made a note over there, my oldest son just started a business a year and a half ago, and I made a note, I'm going to send him out to California to this event next year. That'll be an investment. That'll come out of my posterity line. So my encouragement to you is, the way it all ties together, succession, giving, family, marriage, I think it all ties together in that diagram. And the best way to approach it is to change your thinking. It's not just about the business. It's not just about money. It's about, how do I buy time? Remember what I started with. A life well spent is a life that earns and uses money to buy time to impact people, to be productive, effective citizens in society. It's a life that focuses on the eternal in the realm of the temporal, so that at the end of your life you have no regrets. That's what I realized driving from our Atlanta office after the melanoma diagnosis over to our headquarters, is I realized I had no regrets. Now, I've not done it perfect, but because I began to see this early on, I thought, you know, I'm glad that this diagram has kind of been a beacon that I've focused on, because, you know, when you have that mortality check, you don't want to then say, well, wait a minute, I got to go do this, I got to go do that, I got to make it right with my kids and make it right with whatever. So wherever you are, back up, change your paradigm, and think about all this stuff a little differently. And it really is all integrated. You know, your estate plan needs to integrate with your values transfer, and your values transfer need to integrate with what legacy do you want to leave. So that's my encouragement to you. And I'll leave you with, you know, the Jim Elliot quote, he is no fool who gives up what he cannot keep to gain what he cannot lose. So giving of your time, giving of your money to invest in your kids, invest in FCCI, invest in other things that God's doing around the world, you are not going to regret that. And that's what I pray for you, is that you have no regrets.